Welcome to a Migration Policy Institute podcast series on critical immigration, health, and educational policies affecting young children of immigrants. Introducing each session is Michael Fix, Senior Vice President and Director of Studies and Co-Director of the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. And now here's Michael.
We'll have a panel on health. Randy Capps, my colleague here at MPI, will moderate the session. After that session, we'll open up for your comments and for your questions.
I'm Randy Capps with MPI, and our first session is going to be about children of immigrants and health outcomes and health care. And so if you thought that the issue of immigration was complicated, as we know from the debate surrounding healthcare reform, and we're now going to be in the early implementation of it, that's a very complex issue as well. So one of the things that this panel is going to take up is going to be issues surrounding that, as well as just general patterns of health insurance coverage and healthcare access for immigrants, which is in and of itself a complicated set of issues, and then the health outcomes. All of which are complicated by the varying citizenship and legal status of children and their parents. And I think one just sort of basic fact to bear in mind as we enter into the discussions today is that the vast majority of children in immigrant families are U.S.-born citizens, around 80% or so. And as a result, they do have the access and rights to health care and other benefits on the same grounds as other citizens, but often their parents do not. And for that other 20% of children who are not citizens, things are much more complex. So we have an expert panel here to address this. All three of them are very good friends of mine and colleagues that I have worked with extensively in the past and will continue, hopefully, to collaborate with in the future. They're top experts in different fields. The first paper on health outcomes for children in immigrant families is by Jennifer Van Hook, who, as Michael mentioned, is director of the Population Research Institute at Penn State University. And I should add, as a demographer, this is one of, if not the premier, population centers when it comes to the study of immigrant families and children. Dr. Van Hook has conducted extensive research on settlement and incorporation patterns of U.S. immigrants with a focus not only on children and immigrant families, but also, importantly, on the unauthorized population and all that that means. The second paper will be by Leighton Koo, who is director of the Center for Health Policy Research at George Washington University, who has also been a researcher at the Urban Institute. Dr. Koo is really one of the leading, if not the leading, expert on health insurance coverage and health care access for immigrant families in the U.S. He's been a long time and impassioned advocate on behalf of children and immigrant families in terms of extending public health insurance coverage and other means of access. And then finally, and Dr. Koo's paper will be on health insurance trends and health access trends in this population. And then finally, we will have a commentary from A.J. Tawdry, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Human Services Programs in the Office of Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. He's a longtime researcher also in these areas, and it's great to have someone who not only has the research background in depth. Dr. Tawdry was at the Urban Institute for several years and has also directed some important human service agencies in New York City. It's important to have someone with his depth of experience as well as his impassioned feeling on behalf of children of immigrants in such a powerful position. ASPE, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is the lead agency for commissioning research for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So the three panelists will come up one by one to speak in order, and then after that we'll have a question and answer.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. I'm Jennifer Van Hook from Penn State University, and I'm really thrilled to be here today. These are the kinds of forums where, you know, from an academic's perspective, we all like to think that our research has policy implications or would be used in some other kind of arena to help people make decisions. But really, this would never happen without institutions like MPI, the Foundation for Child Development, to help make those connections, because we don't do it all by ourselves. A few years ago, my colleagues and I, and these are some of the people on the screen there, Nancy Landale, Marianne Hillemeyer, and some others at Penn State, started to think about putting together a large project that would focus on the health and well-being of children of immigrants. And we ended up focusing on Mexican children of immigrants for this particular project, which was ultimately funded by the NIH. And our goal of this project was to put together existing secondary data sets in order to see how far we could get in terms of exploring how is it that children's contexts and changes in children's contexts influence their health and well-being. And by context here, we're really looking at a whole variety of levels of children's context, their immediate family context, their schools, their neighborhoods, the states that they live in, and indeed the whole nation that they live in. Do they live in Mexico or do they live in the United States? What difference does it make when they come here and they change from such a different kind of community and place that they live to living in the United States? And then how do families respond to these sorts of changes in children's environments, and how does this then influence children's health? Today, I just want to provide sort of an overview of some of the ideas that have come out of this project, but also with a nod toward trying to explain or describe the overall picture of the health of children of immigrants. What do we know today in very broad brush strokes? So the overarching message that we're trying to convey here is that, first of all, there's just no single story about the health of children of immigrants because they're just so incredibly diverse. And there's been a lot of discussions in past decades that characterize children of immigrants as being particularly unusually healthy. There's been perplexing discussions about why that is the case. But as more information has come to light about this particular population, we've really uncovered a much more nuanced picture of their health and well-being. Second of all, we want to focus attention specifically on Mexican children of immigrants. And that's just not, I mean, it's partly because we've been working on that topic, but also because this is just an incredibly important group. If we can't just hold up our hands and say, oh, you know, they're so diverse we can't do anything, we can't say anything about this group. Instead, what our strategy is to focus in on the largest and most vulnerable group, which happens to be Mexican. Children of immigrants. Third of all, we're going to be suggesting that we are right now at a critical juncture in history. Where's Doris? Yeah, I mean, this is sort of in line with what you said so nicely in the last talk. But I think we're sort of at a crossroads right now in terms of making important decisions that could ultimately have lasting impacts on these children and what their lives look like as they live out their and become adults in our population. So why is childhood health so important? Well, developmental psychologists, people who study life course and health, all of that really emphasize how early childhood is a particularly critical period for establishing patterns of health and vulnerabilities that last throughout a lifetime. And so if children in early childhood and early infancy even, or even prenatally, experience especially adverse conditions, this can have lasting impact on adult health and longevity. In terms of when we think about immigrants in particular, this could also have a lot of impact on their economic productivity as adults because of the strong intertwining between cognitive development and health, physical health for children. These are all wrapped together. Another thing that we want to say, and I think this is just sort of getting at sort of the morality of the whole issue, is that health inequality is perhaps one of the most consequential forms of inequality because it really has an impact on the quality of our lives and the length of our lives. how long, how many years do we have? And for some groups of people, to have shorter lives than others, this is probably the harshest form of inequality. As Randy said, most children of immigrants are U.S. citizens. And so if we're seeing large discrepancies or disparities across groups, you know, what does this say then about the principles of fairness in our society and how, you know, does every citizen get a fair shot in life or not? And I think if we look at the data, the answer is no in actuality. So, resilience and risk. Okay, so the traditional story about children of immigrants going back to the mid-1980s, perhaps earlier than that, has been this immigrant health paradox story. And what this story is it really tells a story about infants and infant health outcomes. Because we have a lot of data about infant mortality, and we've always had a lot of data about infant mortality. So we know that children of immigrant mothers, have particularly healthy starts in life. They have lower infant mortality than you would ever imagine, given how poor their parents are. And they have really healthy birth outcomes. And to some degree, we've seen that this immigrant advantage sometimes extends into adolescence and early adulthood. So, for example, we see this in terms of health behaviors like smoking, lower levels of smoking among immigrant adolescents, lower levels of drug abuse, and among adolescents, also lower levels of obesity. And so these are really important things to keep in mind. And so when we seek to explain this, it's often the explanation is that immigrant culture and social supports amongst immigrant communities and families is protecting these children despite their poverty and lower socioeconomic status. However, in the last 10 years or so, there's been an emergence of some incredibly new rich data sources that track children from birth into middle childhood. And these data sources are now painting a more mixed and nuanced picture of the health of children of immigrants. Some of this research pretty strongly shows that these advantages that children of immigrants have in infancy are still seen in these data sets, but they erode over time such that by the time the kids reach kindergarten, they're in worse health overall, if we just think about general health, than children of natives. And so then this is having consequences for their ability to do well in school. They might come to school in kindergarten with lower levels of cognitive development as well. And so all of this is interesting, and I think it really raises our awareness of the fact that many immigrant families really are not completely impervious to the kinds of challenges that they have to deal with in the United States. We also see particular issues, pesticide exposure, lower levels of immunization for certain kinds of vaccines. And increasingly now we're seeing very high levels of obesity in early childhood. So now I want to switch over to the issue of Mexican children. And just to give you a demographic picture of what's going on here and why we're focusing on Mexicans, I'm sure you all know, but I just need to say this again. This chart shows the composition of children of immigrants in the United States, and by far Mexicans make up the most of any other even world region. Okay, so a single country, Mexico, is sending, or you know, 38% or producing 38% of children of immigrants, and that's bigger than any other continent in the world. Another interesting point, 10% of all children in the United States are Mexican children of immigrants. And when we think about this in terms of the future, 1 in 3 people in the United States by 2040 is going to be of Hispanic origin. And so this is really, makes this group a particularly important one to pay attention to. It's also important because Mexican children of immigrants stand out as having particularly poor health outcomes compared to other immigrant groups. And like I said, their general health quickly erodes after birth. we're seeing this particularly for Hispanic children, and I think it's probably driven by Mexican children of immigrants. And so you can see here there's a major review of the literature showing Latino children are at elevated risk of a whole host of health issues. One of the issues that I'd want to focus in on is asthma, and this is kind of an interesting one because Mexican children of immigrants actually have a lower prevalence of asthma than other groups when we look at the data. And you can see the statistics there. 10% of Mexican children have asthma compared to 26% of Puerto Ricans, 13% of whites, 16% of black children. So they look like they're really advantaged with respect to asthma. However, children of Mexican immigrants have very low access to health care, as Leighton Koo is going to probably can attest to. And we know that children who don't see doctors regularly are frequently underdiagnosed for asthma. So we don't know how accurate these statistics really are. And another thing to recognize is that among those who do have asthma, we know that Latino children do not get as good care. So in one study that we found, among children who were hospitalized for asthma, they were actually in the hospital for asthma, they were 17% less likely to be prescribed a nebulizer than other children. And we don't know the reason for this, but I mean, it's a pretty stark difference in care. Another issue is overweight and obesity. The trends, of course, I'm sure you know that we're seeing higher levels of childhood obesity than in the past. It might be leveling off, but it's still pretty high. Mexican children are at risk more than other groups. In our own research on Mexican children, what we've learned, when we compare Mexican children living in Mexico with Mexican children living in the United States, that it appears that when they move to the United States, they gain weight pretty rapidly. In this chart, what you see on the left are the children in Mexico subdivided by their propensity to become an immigrant. So the children, as you go in that direction toward the the right, you see that the children who are very, very likely to move to the United States, the very high propensity group, have the lowest likelihood of being overweight or obese compared to other children in Mexico. But when you go to the other side of the line, the right side of the line, we end up we're looking now at children living in the United States. And as you go across generations, we see rapid increases in obesity following migration. A second point we want to make is that the highest group, the group that's most likely to be overweight and obese, is the second generation. So these are the children of immigrants, children of Mexican immigrants living in the United States, and they weigh more than even the children of natives of their same ethnic group. So there's something about being in an immigrant family living in the United States that makes these children particularly vulnerable to overweight and obesity. And we know that this then has large consequences for their health and well-being throughout the rest of their lives. So I only have a few minutes, so I'm just going to kind of whip through some of the challenges that they're facing that we think might have something to do with their health and well-being. Children of Mexican immigrants are more likely than any other group to have parents who don't speak English. They also are more likely than any other group to be in poverty. 40% of them live in poverty or below the poverty threshold. And they're more likely than any other group to have unauthorized parents. So what this chart shows is the percentage of births to unauthorized parents. So among all U.S. births, 9% have an unauthorized parent. Among all immigrant, their births, among all children of immigrants, 35%, about a third, have an unauthorized parent. But among Mexican children of immigrants, 63% have an unauthorized parent. So if we think this is just a side issue, it isn't. It's affecting the majority of these children. Also, we know that they're being dispersed across different states. What this shows is the percentage of children of immigrants living in each state. And so this is just selected states. It's 15% or more. And so I don't really have a whole lot of time to go over this, but we can talk about it later. But all it does is just demonstrate is that we're seeing immigrants appearing in places that haven't had a lot of experience with immigrants. And so this could have consequences for their health and their health care. So in terms of policy directions, it's harder to say when it comes to health, because I think the major policy direction is health care, which Leighton is going to be talking about next. But if we want to think about health in a more holistic way, more than just preventing or curing illness or addressing problems after they come up, then I think to some degree we need to be starting to think about health in terms of all of these challenges that are confronting children in immigrant families. And one is legal status problem, because we believe that children in unauthorized immigrant families are just not getting the same kind of a care, and they might be under certain kinds of stress that could jeopardize their health status. We also believe that we need to think about the provision of services for children's welfare, particularly children in unauthorized or non-citizen families. And then finally, we need to think about special attention to new destinations so that the infrastructure is in place for the provision of services to children in those places. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Leighton Koo, and first of all, I want to mention my co-author, Mary Ellen Jewers, who actually here in the audience, a wonderfully bright doctoral student here at GW University, so a very promising young scholar unto herself. One of the things I want to start with, because not only are we on the eve of an inauguration, we're on the eve of Martin Luther King Day, is just to start out with a quote that I think is important to remember. Of all the forms of inequality. And so this was stated almost 50 years ago, that injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And I think that's one of the things that drives people in this area to be very concerned that this is one of these things. Health is a fundamental aspect of life. Access to healthcare is not the only thing that affects health, but clearly is one of the things that we as a society can try to do to improve health. I want to start out. I know we're hopefully on the eve of some sort of immigration reform bill. I, like many other people around the country, am still battered, beaten by what happened with health care reform and the Affordable Care Act. And I will say there's part of me that worries. You have what was probably the most controversial topic over the last year, which was health reform. You add to it the prospects of immigration reform. And do we have something that is not merely controversial but explosive? Maybe. And so that's just something to consider in general. What I want to really do in this talk is review sort of three main areas, health insurance coverage, access to health care, and then reduction in language and cultural barriers. So here are some, I'm a research app, some graphs, some numbers. So merely trying to prove things that I think hopefully most of you were already aware of is that low-income children who are themselves non-citizen children, so that is what sort of appears blackish on the right-hand side of this slide, are roughly speaking three times more likely to be uninsured than citizen children who have citizen parents. And then somewhere in the middle, though a little bit more likely to be uninsured than the citizen children with citizen parents or citizen children with immigrant parents, with non-citizen parents. Now, the thing that I think is less known by many people is, to my mind, one of the big drivers of this really has to do with gaps in private insurance coverage. So what you see are distinct gaps in private insurance coverage for citizen children with citizen parents, citizen children with non-citizen parents, and non-citizen children. And it's because the typical way that you get private health insurance is through the parent and who has employer-sponsored coverage. And there's strong evidence that, essentially speaking, non-citizen parents have very low access. They're not offered health insurance at the job, unlike most of us, and part of it has to do with the types of jobs they have, you know, working in agriculture, working in restaurants, working in service jobs. Some of it might be some measure of exploitation and discrimination. You know, some of these things are less clear. And then they're better known is that there are gaps in public insurance coverage. Non-citizen children have less access because of eligibility restrictions to Medicaid, which is the main form of public insurance in CHIP that's relevant to immigrant kids. Though actually citizen children with non-citizen parents fare relatively well. There has been extensive outreach over the years and efforts to try to make sure that the U.S.-born children within immigrant parents can get coverage. And so they are slightly above or roughly comparable to the level of coverage for citizen children. And then the other thing that's actually quite distinctive, often amazes people, as you look at the low-income kids in the U.S., really a majority of low-income kids in the U.S. Have Medicaid or CHIP coverage. And that is the dominant form of health insurance coverage today for low-income children in the U.S. Here's the situation for adults in which the patterns with respect to the native-born adults and non-citizen children are, if anything, a little clearer. There you see for adults, so this is including not only parents but childless adults, basically speaking, the low-income non-citizens are roughly speaking twice as likely to be uninsured. Naturalized citizens, again, relatively close to the native-born, but still a little more likely to be uninsured. Once again, you see some gaps in private insurance coverage for the non-citizen adults. Once again, part of this really has to do with sort of gaps in employer-sponsored coverage, and then fairly clear gaps in terms of public coverage. Once again, this is mostly Medicaid that we're talking about. Simply put, a lot of non-citizens are ineligible because of eligibility restrictions that are imposed by federal or state law for public insurance coverage. So, some of the key reasons for low insurance coverage, again, we know a lot because of the explicit eligibility restrictions for Medicaid, have to do with public insurance coverage. On the other hand, what I really say is one of the big drivers that is less clear, less noticed to people, really is the fact that there are differences in the availability of employer-sponsored coverage and private insurance coverage that affects, parents and therefore their children, regardless whether their children are citizens or not. So we talked about the eligibility restrictions. So the other thing, of course, is, what are what's the nature of the Medicaid restrictions? Legal immigrants may be eligible for Medicaid in certain cases, particularly if they've been in the U.S. for more than 5 years, though there are certain exceptions that are sort of complicated, but for groups like refugees and certain others. For the undocumented and for people who are temporary or provisional immigrants, typically speaking, they are ineligible for Medicaid. One of the signature things that happened earlier, actually one of the very first pieces of legislation that President Obama signed was the passage of the Immigrant Children's Health Improvement Act, which was actually a subpart of the Children's Health Insurance Program Reauthorization, and I'll say I helped work on this legislation for more than a decade. It took more than a decade to get this little piece of legislation passed, which was merely to give states the option to restore eligibility to legal immigrant children and pregnant women without a 5-year waiting period. So, I will say when it was initially designed soon after the 1996 welfare restrictions, people thought, well, this is such a softball thing. Asking states to have the option, not required. It's children and pregnant women, for God's sake. How can you say no? And the answer is it took more than a decade to get even that modest change made. Nonetheless, it's been fairly effective. So since that was passed, about half the states have used this option to provide coverage for children. About a third of the states have extended coverage to pregnant women. And then many of these states already were providing coverage using state funds for the insurance coverage. But the thing that to me is really impressive is there were 9 states that actually expanded children's coverage before this law was available, did not provide coverage to immigrant children. And then despite the fact that there's a recession, states have been cutting things left and right, they actually expanded children's coverage for legal immigrant children. And there are a remarkably diverse set of states. So it's places like Illinois, Iowa, Montana, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oregon, Texas, Vermont, Washington, some of these, Vermont, you might think, Oregon, these are lefty states. But Texas, North Carolina, Iowa, I'm not sure I'd go that far. So it's really remarkable that there has been some ability to do things on a bipartisan basis, even though there was a recession that was going on in the state, so budgets were tight. And Medicaid is not a real popular topic in lots of states, as many of you might know. So the Affordable Care Act, what is this going to do? And so this really will have a big change for everybody in the country, including citizens and non-citizens alike. So one of the things that helps get at the gaps for immigrants is it expands private health insurance for legal immigrants. We're going to be creating these health, so-called health insurance exchanges. I'm actually helping to start the one in D.C. There are going to be federal tax subsidies for people who have incomes between 100 and 400% of poverty if you're otherwise ineligible for insurance. Now, what happens, so for legal immigrants who are in this income bracket, sort of, you know, roughly speaking, moderately poor to middle income, there's clearly some tax subsidies. Because of the restrictions that existed for legal immigrants under Medicaid, actually there was a further clause that for illegal immigrants who have been in the U.S. for less than 5 years, they can participate in the health insurance exchanges and get federal tax subsidies, even if they are below the poverty line. So this was an explicit effort to help out the people who have otherwise been excluded from Medicaid coverage. So the federal government would step up in this area. There's a Medicaid expansion that's going to go to 133% of poverty. To give you a sense of the scope of that, for example, in my home state of Texas, eligibility, if you're a childless adult, you're just not eligible. Doesn't matter how poor you are, zip. On the other hand, if you are a parent, so if you're a mother with two young children, if your income is maybe $5,000, $6,000, you're making too much money. So it's going to go up substantially, depending on the states. Now, on the other hand, we do know the Supreme Court made this optional for states. So which states are going to expand Medicaid, which states are not, there's still a guessing game. People still aren't quite sure. This is probably going to be a big issue in state legislatures this year. Once again, one of the things that pained many immigration advocates was the undocumented immigrants are ineligible for, continue to be ineligible, even for the exchanges at all. Even if they can't buy insurance on the exchanges, even if they were going to pay fully on their own, they're still ineligible for Medicaid. What sort of brought this pain a little further was that recently when President Obama created the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the DACA youth, I'm sorry, I still can't think of them, the Dream Act kids. They're still ineligible for the exchanges and for Medicaid. So, you know, there's still some precedent, despite the fact that they are no longer exactly undocumented, they're still excluded. So the next topic is shifting to healthcare access. And I begin by saying that health insurance coverage and healthcare access are not synonymous. One of the things that worries many people, myself included, is that in 2014 we're going to see a big expansion of health insurance coverage. We're not necessarily going to see a lot more doctors or clinics in the country. And so, again, there can be issues that people can have health insurance cards, not be able to get access. Conversely, right now there are a number of safety net providers who, even if you're uninsured, you can still go get access to health care on a free or sliding scale basis. So it's not exactly synonymous. Health insurance coverage is unquestionably one of the major factors that immigrants have less access to health care. It's just simply less financially available to them because insurance helps cover so much of the cost for health care. In addition, there are other problems. There's language barriers. There are cultural differences. There's different perceptions of what constitutes need for medical care. And particularly one of the things that comes up is in many immigrant communities, mental health issues are particularly stigmatized. And so the notion, and I'll be honest and say sort of in my own growing up in a Chinese family, you know, the notion of going to talk to someone about your behavioral problems or mental health needs, you know, you've got to be crazy to talk about that. So finally, and then there are some worries about legal status that occur. For many immigrants, even if they're here legally, they may worry in some manner, shape, or form, I may do something that jeopardizes my legal status. So what do we know about healthcare access? Once again, we can show there's less access for immigrant children and immigrant adults. This is one of a simple measure. Did you go to an office-based medical care? Basically, did you see a doctor in the last year? This is low-income children. Yellow is native-born, blackish is immigrants, and so, you know, immigrant children in general are about, roughly speaking, a third less likely to have seen a doctor at all. If you're uninsured, it's low for both native-born and immigrant children. There are huge gaps if you have private insurance. Maybe some of this has to do with the sort of deductibles and copays that are associated with insurance that create additional financial access barriers. And even if you have public insurance, you're a little bit less likely to see a doctor if you're an immigrant child. Same sort of pattern once again for adults. Though in this case, in general, regardless of what type of insurance you have, immigrants are less likely to have seen a doctor than equivalent citizen or native-born low-income adults. Less likely in general. Once again, insurance matters. If you're uninsured, whether you're an immigrant or a citizen, you're just less likely to have seen a doctor. Now, next I want to talk about emergency room care. And this is because this is one of the things that comes up all the time as sort of one of these things. There's this common myth. Immigrants, particularly undocumented immigrants, are flooding emergency rooms, driving hospitals into bankruptcy. And guess what? It's not true at all. Or in general, not true. I can't say that there's no single hospital where there aren't any issues. But in general, when we look at information that comes from surveys, it's very clear this is for immigrant children. What's the likelihood that you had an emergency room visit for low-income children based on whether you're native-born or immigrant? In general, the immigrants are less likely. Once again, particularly if you have private insurance, if you have public insurance, the immigrants were a little more likely to have an emergency room care. And in general, the likelihood of having emergency room care is relatively low if you're uninsured in general. The pattern is much clearer if you're talking about immigrant adults. Here, immigrant adults in general are roughly speaking about half as likely to go in an emergency room as native-born adults, regardless of insurance status. Once again, whether you're uninsured, private insurance, public insurance, less likely to go in emergency rooms. Now, what I'll mention just sort of in passing, there's no graph for this. Periodically, people say, this is all based on survey data. People lie. So how can you trust this? And I will say, this is a survey research. Yeah, it's a reasonable question. There is some administrative data that comes through. There had been a special program called Section 1011, which was a special program set up to help fund emergency care for undocumented, uninsured immigrants that was set up in 2008. We've looked through the administrative data. Initially, when this law was passed, set up a $1 billion fund to pay for this care. It was supposed to last over 4 years. The people who were saying the undocumented are flooding and destroying emergency rooms said $1 billion over 4 years, $250 million a year. That's peanuts. That'll be used up immediately. And the answer was, that's not true. After 8 years, they still haven't used all the money. It still remains the case that this money, which represents a very small proportion, I think maybe, as I recall, less than 0.5% of total emergency room costs in the country, still has not been used. So the notion that undocumented immigrants are, at least from administrative data, it's not as though hospitals were saying, yes, we need to have these bills paid. So language barriers. And in general, so this is a broad statement, Jenny had some more relevant statistics, about 30% of immigrants in the U.S. Don't speak English at all or don't speak it well. And so you have the classic problem of a failure to communicate. That is not only healthcare, this is everything that happens to immigrants. If you can't talk to people, if they can't understand you, guess what? You can't communicate. And communication is at the heart of medicine. If people cannot communicate, they can't make proper diagnosis, they can't give proper treatment, they can't tell patients how to sort of adhere to the medication treatments, their regimens. So it's a problem. Now, in the Clinton administration, fairly early on, in part thanks to a wonderful guy named Tom Perez, who's now the Assistant Secretary of Justice for Civil Rights Issues, there was an executive order that basically said that healthcare providers in general had to provide language assistance to people who were limited English proficient. However, in practice, it hasn't worked very well. And there are both financial and logistical impediments to getting language services. And for those of you who are in the healthcare area, or those of you who tried to deal with sort of language assistance in other areas, you can begin to understand some of the problems. Part of it is there's not money to pay for interpreters or for other sorts of services in general. And frankly, it's sort of a hassle to have to arrange for an interpreter or for a language line, and so on. Nonetheless, there's some gradual progress that's being made. A big deal in healthcare these days is measuring healthcare quality. So some of the principal bodies that measure healthcare quality, particularly for hospitals, have now established language standards that basically say this is part of the way that a hospital can be accredited if it shows that it was doing something, and I will say, however, the what that something is often fairly vague, to provide language assistance. The Affordable Care Act actually required additional reporting about patients' primary languages as part of this so they can be better monitoring over time. And one of the problems when I looked at information about sort of patient errors and medical, I mean, there's a huge literature about medical errors. When you look at what the evidence that relates to language, there's not much. And part of it is because it's not on the medical records, what language people spoke. So you can't figure out who had the medical errors. So this is hoping to try to resolve some of those issues. So anyway, coming back to immigration reform, you know, it's a little too early to assess. I mean, I'd say, you know, anything that you do in this area is going to be controversial, and you have this dilemma. If you try to be really ambitious, you may jeopardize the overall prospects for immigration reform. If, on the other hand, you avoid it altogether, you can miss an important opportunity. So there's some incremental things we can do. So states should try to expand Medicaid. I'd say that in general, regardless of whether they're talking about immigrants or not. The IKEA option, lots of states could take this up. This is a fairly inexpensive thing that could be done in states if states want to show they're immigrant-friendly, and it's cheap to do. More outreach when we deal more with health reform implementation, and sort of adequate funding for safety net providers who are the ones who are providing a lot of care to immigrant populations. On language, one of the critical things that hopefully we can do is begin to pay reimbursements for language services, particularly in Medicare, because Medicare tends to set the standard for private insurance and for Medicaid. We need to do a better job of monitoring what's happening in language assistance. Actually, we don't have particularly good surveys that show, you know, how often are hospitals or doctors providing language services. And finally, I'll say there's some technological advances that might happen. Many of us are probably carrying smartphones in our pockets or our you know, your purses or whatever. You know, it's amazing what these technological innovations could be. I wouldn't be surprised if we have a better ability to have sort of automated translation and interpretation services within the not-so-far future, but obviously this happens. We need to test them to make sure that they're actually doing that interpretation and translation properly and effectively, because if there are errors, it could be serious. So there are lots of things that can happen, both through policy as well as through, again, things like technological innovations. Thanks.
And I'm delighted to say that A.J. Chaudhry, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation of HHS.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to have a few minutes to reflect on these two great presentations. Before I start, let me thank the Migration Policy Institute for hosting today's gathering and inviting me to be part of the event. I spoke recently at another MPI event, so I hope I don't wear out my welcome here. I want to also thank the Foundation for Child Development for its decade-long support on research on children of immigrants. FCD has had the foresight to see long before most that these children, given their size, attributes, and potential, represented the cutting edge of America's future. By supporting both timely research and the development of scholars who could inform public policy formulation with this key cohort of young Americans in mind, FCD has served the nation's own development and prospects. I'm currently the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Human Services Policy at HHS. I am more knowledgeable about the other H in HHS, Human Services, and am not a health policy expert by any means. But one reason I agreed to offer some policy reflections for this session on health is, one, I do know a little bit about children of immigrants from my own prior work, and I've always held Jenny Van Hook's and Leighton Koo's work in very high regard, and I've always learned a lot from getting the chance to read anything that they wrote. And I thought the only way they'll actually get a chance to read these papers is if I commit to talking about them. So thank you. I learned a lot from what you had to say. So in saying yes, what I'm mostly going to reflect on is some important insights I took away from the papers, and as well as I was making some notes based on today's presentation as well. These are excellent and informative papers that remind us how important it is to continue working to understand and improve the health of children in immigrant families. These children now represent 1 in 4 of all children in the U.S., and ensuring their health and well-being is a moral imperative. They are a quarter of us, and it is also critical to ensure So that makes them also critical to ensure our country's continued social and economic prosperity. Having focused more of my attention in policy research and in policy development on the economic well-being and educational development of children of immigrants, I actually came away from this work with a sense of hope and a sense of that in the case of children's health access and opportunities, we have been on what seems to me a fairly better trajectory of progress in this domain, and with clear, visible possibilities of still further progress before us in the coming years. And I think, you know, Leighton Koo and his co-author, Mary Ellen Jewers, do a very good job describing the progress that has been made in the last decade on, as the slides just showed us, in health insurance coverage for immigrant families, especially children, much more so than their parents, improved access to healthcare services, and some, albeit small, reductions in language and cultural barriers. As Leighton also pointed out, within days of his taking office, the president signed CHIPRA, the reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program, which included an option for states to cover lawfully present pregnant women and children under Medicaid and CHIP without the 5-year wait that has generally applied to legal immigrants since 1996. So for 24 states have implemented this option, and these include several of the largest states with immigrant populations, including California, Texas, Illinois, and New York. So while it is still a bit less than half of the states, it is a significant majority of the expecting mothers and children now do have health insurance coverage because of this option. Some of them were doing it already, but this has actually led more of them to do it. And like Leighton, I am hopeful that with the option there and in better economic times, maybe more will take it up, especially if they're also taking up some of their estate taking up the Medicaid expansions. So in every year since 2008, there has been widespread progress in reducing the level of uninsured eligible children. And this builds on prior increases since the passage of CHIP in 1998 for both Medicaid and CHIP. And this occurred for nearly all subgroups of children across the majority of states. And this included comparable or larger improvements during this time for children of immigrants. So again, I think that it's important to sort of note that progress, which I think Leighton does, where we have almost near parity for citizen children with non-citizen parents who share the same access across all states in public insurance coverage. And as you all know, a major, historic, and hard-fought accomplishment of this administration has been the passage of health reform under the Affordable Care Act. The ACA should significantly increase health insurance coverage and help many children and immigrant families, as it will for many other children and families who have low and moderate family incomes. As the paper by Koo and Jewers points out, the ACA is likely to further increase health insurance coverage for children and immigrant families and their parents, both through the expansion of Medicaid and CHIP where eligible and where the expansion occurs, and through increased access to health insurance through the exchanges and through the new forms of navigating health insurance coverage like the navigators, and by providing sliding scale subsidies based on income to help cover insurance premiums. For the majority of immigrants, these provisions are the same as they are for the rest of the population. Naturalized citizens and lawfully residing immigrants who have been in the U.S. for more than 5 years will have the same opportunity to obtain health insurance coverage as native-born citizens under the ACA. Those with incomes between 133% and 400% of poverty that lack access to affordable employer-sponsored coverage, which is a majority from what, at least in the lower ranks of that income distribution, as Leighton said, will qualify for subsidized coverage under the new exchanges. Thus, the ACA is expected to lead to substantial reductions in uninsured rates among these immigrant groups. Projected impacts will be strongest for immigrants who live in states that do not currently cover many non-elderly adults in their Medicaid program and those that achieve high take-up among the Medicaid and exchange-eligible population. Clearly, the Supreme Court decision will create much more variability. I mean, there already is lots of variability in the level of coverage, and that sort of patchwork of health insurance coverage will likely become exacerbated, at least in the near term, as some states initially take up the Medicaid expansion possibilities and maybe more do over time. Furthermore, while low-income lawfully present immigrants in most states still face a five-year wait on their eligibility for Medicaid and CHIP, once the exchanges are operating, they should be able to purchase insurance and benefit from premium support and cost-sharing subsidies and, after 5 years, transition to Medicaid if their incomes are below 133%. As has also been noted, unauthorized immigrants will remain ineligible for Medicaid and CHIP and will not be eligible to obtain health insurance under the exchange either through premium support or using their own funds. Children of immigrants with one or more unauthorized immigrants make up 1 in 4 of all children of immigrants. And so it's going to be extremely important, and they have lagged behind in some ways the same sort of robust coverage that children with non-citizens in general have reached. And so this is one more shot through ACA implementation to sort of say, can we do even further outreach through this process? Is there a way to develop tools to make the portals as user-friendly to these families as possible? And could the navigators help these families with mixed eligibility reach necessary for expanding coverage to these children? So I had, when I was doing research in this area, had the opportunity to go to Massachusetts and study what they had done to expand coverage. And I was actually quite amazed at how focused they were on language differences and other cultural barriers and how they had sort of designed the navigator position and rolled out outreach to the communities to sort of make sure, and the level of take-up they were able to get. I mean, not every state is Massachusetts. I certainly know that, but I think that does portend possibly a really another shot at this, in some states where this will happen. So my colleagues at CMS and throughout the department are working hard to maximize the coverage of all eligible children, either through Medicaid CHIP or the health exchanges, including those immigrant families where one member or more may be unauthorized, but the children are eligible. And for the most part, they're already eligible. So Jenny Van Hook and her colleagues focus in their paper on the largest of the children of immigrant populations, those in Mexican immigrant families, who are more likely to be unauthorized than other immigrants, as she shows, and who make up a majority of the mixed-status families in this country. This may limit the relative increases in their rates of health insurance and coverage and improvements for their children. And there are reasons to be deeply concerned about that. The lawfully present Mexican immigrant families are also more likely to be low-income. So of that population, they might disproportionately also benefit from the expansion in coverage from which they have not had access to before, particularly among low-wage, lawfully present workers. Even though the ACA will likely bring significant positive benefits to children and immigrant families, several challenges remain that are highlighted in the papers. Both papers point out the linguistic and cultural barriers that can inhibit access to care by immigrants and children in immigrant families. Achieving high rates of take-up in Medicaid and in exchange subsidies among immigrant families will require addressing language barriers to enrollment and addressing issues particularly facing mixed immigrant status families, in which many citizen children now live. Among other things, the ACA requires health plans and the exchanges to provide information in a culturally and linguistically appropriate manner. But as Leighton pointed out, having the guidance in place, just like Tom Perez's guidance in 2000, is one thing. Making sure that states then follow through is important. A second challenge is we are facing what will likely be a patchwork of progress across the nation in terms of Medicaid expansion and the pace and the readiness of implementation. A lot is now going to be determined by the states. I think, as much as our attention is focused here so exclusively on what can happen in the halls of Congress and in D.C. In terms of health insurance coverage, more rests with the states at the moment than with the national government. I mean, HHS is, I attest to, is doing everything it can to sort of push these issues, issuing rules, guidances, and regulations. But we will have a system where some states will do more than the others. And that is something that scholars have to carefully watch and study. I mean, you know, having learned the little I learned from the study we did in Massachusetts, I'm fascinated to find out what will happen in a state like California and how that might contrast with a state like Florida. And documenting that is going to be extremely important. The final positive thing, or related thing I want to discuss, because this came up also when we were visiting Massachusetts, was Q and Jewers discussed the very important role that community health centers have played in developing and implementing policies and programs to effectively overcome these barriers, and how important these institutions are. The ACA provided additional funding that has gone out and has been particularly focused at communities where there are high uninsurance rates and where maybe coverage will not reach. That was all done prior to the idea that some states may not implement Medicaid expansion. It'll be interesting to see how the role of community health centers play both in communities that do expansion, because they're a major source. In Massachusetts, they became a major source for insured providers as well. And I think I'll leave it there. I'll say one last thing, that today's gathering, even though we're starting here on healthcare, is not to focus on what health reform pretends for children and immigrant families. As important and promising as the next few years' work will be in that area, these authors, the audience, certainly Doris Meiser's starting comments are contemplating what immigration reform can bring and the potential for that to further improve the health, well-being, and security of immigrant families and children in immigrant families. President Obama has made clear that this is one of his top priorities this year, and I greatly hope it can be accomplished. As Leighton pointed out, these are not easy issues. There's no feigning from taking on the hard challenges as was done in 2009 when decided to put health reform at the very first issue that he would deal with. I have no idea myself. I'm anticipating the question, so I'll say it now. I have no idea myself. There will be much in the way of health policy as it relates to immigrants thrown into the mix in the forthcoming debates. As Leighton suggests, together they might represent a toxic brew. I mean, I think his language was even stronger, an explosive brew. As we all know, comprehensive reform will require legislative action. The president can push, and I, for one, am somebody who does not pretend to know what today's Congress is ready to address with the level of reasoning compromise that will be required to address these important issues.
Okay, we have a few minutes question and answer, and the way that we want to do this, as we did after the keynote address, is if you have a question, please hold up your hand and we'll get you a microphone. We want you to please identify yourself by name and affiliation, and please keep the questions short so that we can get several of them in.
Thank you very much, Deborah Phillips. This was just a fabulous panel, and AJ, thanks for your usually very cogent and insightful comments. I had to get the microphone, first of all, to acknowledge another FCD board member who is here. Hiro, where are you? Thank you, and my deep apologies to you for not mentioning. Hiro Yoshikawa himself, as you know, is himself an expert on immigrant children, so he's a vital member of the board representing this area of work, and he does 100 other things as well. So very glad you're here with us. I'm going to put on my nerdy academic hat for a moment. And Leighton, I wanted to ask you about this. It's actually figure three, where you have the private insurance and the kids, and the immigrant kids with private insurance are much less likely to get medical visit than the immigrant kids with the public insurance. And a lot of us who are not very, I don't know much about health insurance, sort of view the public insurance as picking up the gap from the private insurance. But this is a way in which the private insurance is a big problem, I think. And what does that imply about the role of the exchanges in ACA?
why there's that big gap in healthcare access and utilization when you're privately insured is a bit of a mystery. I mean, you know, traditional theory suggests that one of the big factors ends up having to do with cost sharing. So, you know, it's the sort of thing, if you have private health insurance, but if, say, you have a $2,000 deductible, I've got news. That means you need to pay the first $2,000 up front before you go see the doctor or before the insurance company starts picking it up. It is plausible that many of the insurance policies that immigrants have when they're private insurance are really skimpy, bare-bones policies. So consequently, they're going to have, you know, some of these cost-sharing barriers. There may be some of these other things going on relating to language barriers and other cultural barriers. Now, hopefully that will be less of an issue with the ACA. The ACA provides further support in terms of cost-sharing for low-income people. And so it certainly would be equal regardless of whether you're an immigrant or not an immigrant. So hopefully, you know, it'll ease some of those barriers. You know, there still will be some of those things as far as to the extent that there are issues like language barriers or other cultural barriers. They may still exist. Hopefully for language barriers we can do more and more about trying to erase some of those language barriers. But I'll be honest and tell you, I don't know how to resolve all those gaps fully. I'll say the other thing that I think maybe that comes in is insurance rules are extraordinarily complicated. I mean, anyone who lives with a managed care system realizes at certain points how hard it is to navigate. And, you know, for those of us who've grown up in the U.S. sort of figure out this is how you do it, you pick this kind of a doctor, you have that kind of a plan, you see this person first, you see that person, you get authorization from the insurance company. I think to many immigrants, that could just be mind-blowing, because that is so contrary to the way you would do something else. So that's another issue that may be going on.
Good morning. My name is Ileana Reyes. I'm from the University of Arizona in Tucson. I come from a more cross-cultural comparative perspective in terms of language, but I was just thinking of the last point, the late, and I know the work also in terms of implications for Jennifer's work. To think beyond language as a barrier. I'm always surprised in your last point, you know, about technology obviously will help us advance communication. And I think obviously language could be also used as a tool. You know, it's a basic, you know, tool for communication. And I'm thinking of a comment that you made before in terms of how sometimes immigrant communities think, well, you know, if I will be considered maybe like crazy or like out of, you know, line if I go and see a doctor and say this. So I'm thinking here more by culturalism. If in any way you research or is there any way to translate to, besides bilingualism and language barriers, language as a tool, but also cultural aspects to be translated as a tool in order for these communities to understand the importance of, obviously, of health here in the U.S., but also for us as program and services providers to understand where they're coming from. Because it might be that in their country of origin, they may not necessarily went to the doctor either, not because of language. They might have, you know, they may speak Spanish in Mexico, but they may not necessarily, you know, go to the doctor either. So I'm just thinking in terms of both research, academic-wise, but how could we help and move that agenda forward to translate also this biculturalism from their perspective, but also from our perspective?
I don't have all the answers, and I don't know, Jenny or AJ, do you have thoughts? I mean, certainly this is where the role of, you know, I've talked about interpreters and language assistants. I mean, part of their role is not only to do the sort of, you know, mechanical translation of words, but part of it is to help bridge some of those cultural barriers to the extent that that's possible. And there are places that have tried very, very hard to not merely provide language services, but sort of try to really be multicultural and have cultural sensitivity. So, for example, Mary Ellen, as I recall, your mother works at Cambridge Health Alliance, which is probably one of the premier places in the country that's worked very hard in trying to ensure that they have, you know, not only language capabilities, but cultural capabilities to help deal with patients that are coming from, you know, multiple different ethnicities and multiple different cultural sources.
I would just add to that as well. You know, I think everybody wants healthy children, and but what people define as health or what you do to produce healthy children can be different in different contexts. And so In the case of obesity and nutrition and that sort of thing in Mexico, at least for our kids that we've been looking at, there's a different notion sometimes of what a healthy weight is for a child, especially in the context of food insecurity. And so in Mexico, and especially and among Mexican immigrant families, food insecurity is very high. And so the kinds of concerns that you might have about nutrition could be quite different than wanting to prevent your children from overeating, you know, because maybe that's not it in the top of your mind. And given the kinds of constraints these people are under, it may be instead that we need to make sure that these children have a steady and reliable supply of healthy foods. What I'm saying is, like, when you're coming from those other kinds of contexts of high deprivation, I think you could have a different kind of reaction. And it's not that people need to be totally re-educated, but I think that the context of decision-making need to be taken into account.
Hi, good morning. I'm Robert Nathanson, PhD student in the sociology department at Johns Hopkins. My question is for Professor Van Hook. I had a question about the obesity for Mexican living in Mexico and then those immigrant children in the United States. One was a bit of technical. You have the sort of the predicted probability to be an immigrant conditional on you didn't, right? So some sort of matching model where you have a very high propensity to go, but you didn't go, right? And they, you said the predicted odds of obesity is one. And then for those who did go, the one that you wrote, the first generation, but is that really the one and a half generation?
Are you talking about the kids in the U.S.?
The kids in the U.S. The first generation is really the one and a half, maybe, so it came at a relatively early age. So to get to my question, I just wanted you to expound a little bit more about this obesity gap, which you've developed, and talk about if you have any idea why you see this difference between what you label as the first generation and the second, or if that's maybe an artifact of the data.
Okay, so the first generation children in that graph are children born in Mexico who came to the United States.
Right.
And the second generation are children who were born in the United States but whose parents were born in Mexico. So, and the ones in between have to do with duration of residence for those children. So I think there was a group in the middle, and I can't remember what they were. But more than 5 years. Okay. So then they were born in Mexico, but they've been living in the U.S. for a little while. And so that's it's just based on duration of residence. In terms of the children, I don't know. Do you have any questions? Are you asking why they're
so? You had to go through the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
You didn't really get to elaborate on this point in the graph, and I just wanted to hear
you. Yeah. The other thing that we're starting to look at sort of factors of what's going on in these children's lives. And we find that these children watch more TV than other groups, which is associated with higher weights. They also, we're finding that the more they eat American-style foods, and they do increase over time, we see higher weights for the kids. So we think it's a combination of things. Why it's so high in the second generation compared to the third or higher, that's another question. And you know, it might be related to some of these issues that I just talked about before, these cultural issues. So,
did we have a question in the back?
Hello, my name is Lucy Brickman. I'm with USCCB, United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, here in Washington, D.C. My question was actually to anybody on the panel or anybody here. You mentioned with the Immigrant Children Health Improvement Act, it talks about the restoring Medicaid for legal immigrant children. But my question was, would that apply to for people that have TPS, temporary protective status? Would they, their child, like, their, because one of the things that we do is we reunify families to sponsors that are already living in the U.S. So those family, those sponsors already have temporary protective status. And so when we reunify the children with them, would that apply as well in order for them to also withdraw Medicaid since their parents have Medicaid?
Sure. And that's sort of a complicated issue. What happened was in the 1996 law that restricted immigrations, there were certain provisions that applied to people who were called Prukhals, people residing under color of law, that applied to a certain group of people who were provisional status. And then that in addition, states were given some discretion in terms of how they wanted to interpret which groups those were in. I'll say as far as when the IKEA provisions have been adopted by states, I'll be honest and say, I mean, typically they focused primarily on the LPR kids, the green card kids, and how they dealt with the sort of Prukhal kids and some of the other people with temporary status. I'm not entirely sure. Among other things, I must admit, I think part of this may simply be because, A, it's an incredibly complicated aspect of immigration law, because there's, like, it's not as though there's a category of these temporary and provisional kids. There are probably dozens of categories for both those kids and adults. I can't honestly say that I know. I think in some cases states certainly have the option to do it. How much they've done it, I'm not sure.
Leighton, could you just say something about how they might be treated under the Affordable Care Act in terms of subsidies for insurance coverage? Do you have a sense of that at all?
Yes, that's a little clearer. The standard within the Affordable Care Act is, are you lawfully present? And so if you are lawfully present, the standard interpretation, though who knows, I don't necessarily know that I know exactly what the regulations have been in this area, includes, lots of the people with temporary and provisional status, because, they are here lawfully and present in the U.S., even if on a temporary period. So as long as they have that lawfully present status, they are eligible for the health insurance exchanges. They are eligible for the tax subsidies that go along with the health insurance exchanges and the cost-sharing reductions and stuff like that. But obviously at a certain point, if their temporary or provisional status ends and they become undocumented again or unauthorized, then they lose that status. But that's at least my interpretation of that slight change in standards that happened under the Affordable Care Act. It's sort of this concept of the lawfully present.
Do we have one or two more questions?
Okay. My name is Alba Hesselroth. I'm a new research fellow at the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at the American University. First of all, thank you so much for such an important information. My question was, have you taken into consideration the difference between children living in urban areas who probably tend to be more obese because they do not have access to parks, to recreation facilities, and probably they have to watch more TV because they have to be inside of the house, and the children that are working in the fields, they are exposed to other kind of health risk. I guess you mentioned this in front of insecticides, or it could be also the fact that they are working long hours under the sun when they are working with their families, these children that have to move from one place to another. Probably they are going to tackle that during the education lecture. But have you taken that into consideration within the children area, this different, how the context in which they live could impact these issues that you have mentioned before?
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't really we don't have good data on these agricultural workers and what their height and weights are, unfortunately, because our data doesn't allow us to disaggregate like that. If we just do an urban-rural or urban-non-urban kind of split, actually the children in urban areas weigh less than the children in suburban settings because they walk more. I think there's a lot more walking in urban settings. It doesn't quite work the way you might think, just because of the sheer amount of time kids spend in the car if they're living in places where you have to use a car to go anywhere.
I think one last quick question.
Well, Michael has one. So.
Maybe two quick questions.
We'll take two. There's one in the back.
Okay, thank you. My name is Helen Tran from the Asian American Justice Center, and this question is for AJ. I was wondering where discussions are on the possibility of restoring DACA-eligible youth to lawfully present categories for qualifying for ACA programs.
I'll be honest. I am unaware. I'm not involved in those discussions. I don't know if they're happening. If you want to give me your information, I can find out and get back to you.
And Michael gets the last question.
I was so interested about the fact that Mexican children don't have very high prevalence rates for asthma. Do you have any theory on why that might be true?
It could be measurement. And the other, I don't really know. If somebody here is an expert on asthma, I would love to hear what they might have to say, but I'm sorry.
I will say that, you know, Jenny's hypothesis that might have to do with sort of underdiagnosis of this is probably at least part of that. I mean, there's you know, some recent evidence. There was a very nice paper that came out in Health Affairs just a month or two ago that basically did point out that sort of, you know, one of the things that happens is that there is a remarkable level of undiagnosis of various health problems for immigrants. And this is based on things like where there's the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, where they actually do physical exams of people, and they sort of look at the physical exams compared to what people are reporting as far as how they view their health status or what's been diagnosed. You know, typically the sorts of questions, you know, about asthma status, you know, sort of the question goes something like, have you ever, you or your child ever been diagnosed as having asthma? Well, if you didn't see a doctor within the past two or three years, you weren't diagnosed as having asthma because there was no one to diagnose it. So there's clearly some level of undiagnosis, but it, you know, like many things unmeasured, it's sort of unknown how much.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Young Children of Immigrants Conference, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/integration.